everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about HR with the people who actually care about it. So let's get to our guest. First time on, Marv, welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hey.
Hey, you're there. Welcome.
Yep, we kind of blanked out a little bit. This is Marv Russell.
Well, awesome. Marv, if you would, introduce yourself to our audience, and then we'll roll right into the big question.
Well, I'm Marv Russell. I've been in human resources about 30 years for several major corporations, both in the United States and other countries around the world. Most recently, I'm a consultant, an HR specialist, author, and speaker for a number of corporations. Spent my time early years at University of Notre Dame, where I had an opportunity to play for the Fighting Irish as a middle linebacker and played on a national championship team, got a master's degree, and trying to finish up a PhD these days. So we're busy trying to write and learn as we go.
I was about to say, trying to finish up a PhD, that's no laughing matter right there at all. tell us what's top of mind for you these days, Mars. What's keeping you up at night?
You know, HR is just a fast-evolving field. No longer are we those transactional people, but everybody that I engage and everybody that I really talk to, I'm really focused on the issues around organizational development. How do you get an organization to grow as individual people, but also collectively as teams and groups and divisions, and being able to work together? And how do you develop? How do you truly develop people and get them prepared, not for the job they're in today, but the job that they need to do tomorrow, and being able to anticipate? And that's the great challenge, especially for the new generation. One of the big challenges is we talk about the entitlement generation. It's this new generation that we have right now. It's a fast-moving generation. They are saturated with social media, new ideas and new thoughts. But, you know, there's also a lot of learning they got to go through. And so there's a constant challenge in that organizational framework to really teach people and to teach bright young minds how to use that information and how to use this.
Well, William?
Hey, Brian.
I think
we lost Marv, but he was on something really good. Can't wait to get him back. I'll tell you, I think I'd like to, because of his sports background, and we don't have a whole lot of folks that have been in professional sports, I'd like to find out what he's learned from sports and his background in football in particular and kind of how that translated over to the organization. So he'll call back in here in a second. How are you?
I am good, man. Working on some plans for an event next time he drops off, because he's got some tech, we got some connectivity things today. So.
Yeah, I think he's back on. Marv,
I'm back on.
Oh, good. No worries. Well, while you were gone, Brian and I were talking a little bit about, you know, we don't have a lot of professional athletes that have been on the show. So I wanted to ask you, you know, out of your experience kind of growing up through that and in coming into HR, what did you learn from sports, sports that kind of easily did he already come bump off again? You're kidding me.
No, it's, we're going to make this work, damn it. We're going to force this. Let's try it again.
Hey, Marv.
Well, we're going to make this
hey,
work,
Marv.
Damn it.
Yeah, Marv, you okay?
I'm there. I'm here.
All righty.
It's
okay.
A challenge, though, right?
It is. Well, we're going to blame some of the cell carriers in New York City. That's what we're going to
okay.
do, Marv. We're just going to blame them. What translated from your sports career to your HR career? Kind of what moved over? What was easily transferable from one to the other?
You know, I wrote a lot about that in my book called Linebacker in the Boardroom, Lessons in Life and Leadership, and that's what it was all about in that book. What I really learned is three things, and I use those very, very instrumentally in the work that I do, that leaders have to be essential. You have to find what makes you different, what differentiates you from other people. And then number two, you have to perform at an exceptional level. Every single day is a challenge, and it was that way on the field, and it's that way in everyday life. And third, ethics matter, the essential, the exceptional, and the ethical leader. The ethics matter. People care how you get the job done. And that's one of the things I learned from playing for a great coach like Eric Parsegian back in the 70s, is that I had to be essential. I had to really differentiate myself, and I had to be exceptional each and every day in practice as well as on the field, and I had to do it the right way. And that's what I try to teach people in everyday life, and that's been the whole foundation for the work that I do today.
It's funny because of the sports I follow English football, soccer. And a couple of clubs kind of follow that mentality that it's not just about winning. You know, you can win, you can buy the best players, and you can just win, but the problem is it's winning, the right way. And so there's a philosophy that goes with that. That is different, I would tell you. You know, what about the different generations as you're kind of going in and out of organizations? How do the different generations kind of, when you say winning, the right way, how do the different generations kind of contend with that?
Well, you know, it is very, very different. You know, when we came up, you know, I'm assuming you're like me, I'm a baby boomer. You know, winning has been everything. You know, sports was a great context for that. And in business, winning was everything, being the best, you know, and that's so American of us, and that's fine and that's great. But this newer generation does have a different mentality. And even if you take sports, you know, if your child's in the local program for a little league or Pop Warner football, everybody gets a trophy, you know, so everybody's a winner. So there is a different mentality that we're raising the next generation under. And I do think that creates a different type of environment and different type of culture in organizations, because the expectations are very, very differentiated than what they were before. These young folks, the younger generation, expect success faster. They expect to be brought up in the organization faster. For example, I expect a person who takes a new job to stay in that job 18 months to 2 years. First, you got to learn a job, learn the organization, learn how to be successful, and then do something. They tend to want to move in 12 months. And I think it's a constant challenge to teach people that first you got to make yourself exceptional, you know, and essential. And then you've got to demonstrate your ability to be able to deliver. So that's a great challenge that I think that we have. And ironically, even with the internship boom that's going on, internships are so important. I just wrote a book on internships called Finding Your Internship. And it's what we need you to, you know, what organizations need you to understand in terms of your growth on the job. So there's going to be this constant struggle, I think, for the next few years to help this next generation understand what success and how success is truly defined.
Well, let's get your take on succession, Marv. As you've probably seen this done well and not done so well, both in sports and in business. What's your kind of personal, if you could kind of blank, you know, a blank screen succession for a new co, how would you go about it?
Well, you know, there's a great example of succession at its finest that's in the news, on the front page of the news right now. It's the young woman who just became the CEO of General Motors. She started at the bottom, I think, like 20 years ago, and she started on the front line as a quality inspector, and today she's the CEO of General Motors. What an incredible story. We don't see that very often, and I wonder if we're going to see it. And I think that's part of really good organizations learn, again, not how to hire a person for today, but hire a person for the future. And that's a combination of looking at potential and other factors that really are going to help people grow. And then you got to have in place in your organization not just a succession plan, but a developmental mentality that's always anticipating what are going to be the needs and the expectations of the company, but also the needs and expectations of that individual. And then giving them the on-the-job assignments that stretch their capabilities. So they have to have goals, and those goals have to stretch what they are doing and can do on a normal everyday track. And when they are able to achieve those goals at a consistent high level, you continue to move them up, and you continue to challenge them. Now, one of the things I think that is also a challenge is everybody thinks, young folks think that turfdom and territory and numbers of people reporting to me are so important. But you know what? The most difficult, challenging jobs and the most influential jobs I've ever had were jobs as a senior executive where I had no authority over people, where I didn't have a team. Senior vice president of organizational development has no authority over the organization. But the skill I had to learn is the ability to influence without authority. And I think that is one of the great new competencies that I'm trying to teach young people and people who are seasoned professionals each day, how to influence by virtue of being essential, how to influence by being exceptional, how to influence by the ethics and the way I do things. And when I'm able to do that, I'm able to sustain a longer-term impact on the organization, and I'm able to grow much faster. So I think that, you know, it's not that difficult to supervise people, but it's very difficult to lead. It's very difficult to influence. And that's where we get our credibility.
Let's stick there for a couple minutes, because I think Brian and I both really like the sentiment of influence without authority. What are some of the tenets there? Like, if you, once again, you walk into a room, a bunch of people staring at you, how do you kind of get them on your page? What are some of the building blocks?
Well, you know, I sit in meetings every day, and you watch people interact, you know, on senior executive teams. There are those who are loud and always have something to say right away. There are those who sit back and listen and never say anything. And then there's those who find the balance. And what I've always tried to do is find that meticulous balance of not only listening, but to demonstrate my, you know, unbridled capacity to hear what they say. Listening doesn't mean being quiet. Listening means being quiet, absorbing information, and giving it back to people so, number one, they acknowledge, you heard what I said, and let me give you a different viewpoint. And you move people that way, because what you've done is you've acknowledged, you know, the acknowledgement that I heard you is very important in establishing influence without authority. And so people do not dismiss what you say. So I always take a lot of pride in being able to sit back. And then I say, when I speak, people are listening to me. You know, so you hold back. And so, you know, I think that that's just an art form. It's a practice form. You know, even today, with all the years of experience I have, I need feedback sometimes. Sometimes my ideas get rolling too fast, and somebody has to yank me and say, Marv, step back, you know? None of us are perfect, so this is always a work in progress. But establishing that buy-in is a real key tenet of influence without authority, being able to listen, demonstrate that you heard, repeating what you heard, and then giving different perspectives and a good rationale why you think the way you do.
What's your take on how women and men kind of approach leadership, either similarly or dissimilarly?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I've had the privilege of working for a predominantly female advocacy organization, very well known in the United States of America, huge name, and very much run by a female-based organization. And I've also worked for those traditional male-dominated organizations. And there's a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. I think one of the differences is in the female-based organization that I've seen that I love is the capacity to really view employees not as employees but as associates, that they are integrated into the organization, and a greater desire to practice diversity and inclusion and expanding the culture to be more inclusive, and also being far more empathetic to the needs and expectations of the new workforce. Now, in the traditional worlds we've been in, it's been very much rock and sock'em. And I think that, you know, we've seen that there's certainly a better way to do that. So there is a difference, but I'll tell you one thing that is the same. The desire for success, the desire for results, the desire and the commitment to succeed is very, very similar in both genders. But the approach is slightly different. I don't think one is better or worse than the other. I think they're very different. But I think both have tenets that are very important and can be implied.
What is your take on career management, especially from an OD perspective? Who owns what? Like employees, what are their expectations? What do they own in terms of their career development and management? And what should a company own?
I gave a lecture a few weeks ago to a group that was interested in developing a comprehensive internship program. And one of the things I said, in my book, Finding Your Internship, is that you got to own it yourself. You got to own your own career. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to be able to manage it, but you have to own it, meaning you have to know what you want and how you're going to get there and constantly be creating a path. Now, what is the organization's role? The organization's role has to be one to provide you the organizational development framework and be willing to give the opportunities and give those stretch assignments. Now, let's accept one fact. When you're doing organizational development, you're doing it well, you're stretching people's capability, they are going to fail sometimes. That's got to be okay, because the greatest lessons in life are from our failures. I think we all know that. You know, the best games that I ever played as an athlete were the ones I lost, not the ones I won, because I was digging down deep, you know, deep down inside you to find the will to win. So you got to own it. And I really, truly believe you got to own your own career development. And that's one of the things that I'm saying to this new generation. You got to own your career, but you also have to learn from the experiences of others. So the lessons of we can send people to tons of training programs. And, you know, we even used to talk about, the, you know, the MBA was the premier degree that you had to have to be successful. I don't buy that anymore. It's much more about the lessons of experience. We look less and less at where people went to school and how many degrees they have versus what they do, what they're doing, the successes they've had, the failures they've had, and how they've responded. A lot of the great work that's done in this area talks about derailment, that we all are going to derail in our careers at different points in times. Heck, you know, it probably, you know, let me count how many times I've been derailed in my career or have lost my job, been laid off. It happens to us. But the ability to be able to right ourselves and move forward is something that's going to be very, very important for people, because the challenge is going to be so great.
Nice. I want to go backwards in time a little bit to when you were recruited to Notre Dame. You could have actually played anywhere. You could have played at Nebraska, USC, Texas, Alabama, a bunch of wonderful teams. You chose Notre Dame. What was the recruiting process like back then?
And, it's kind of funny. You rattled off a whole lot of great schools.
Right.
There was only one for me. Notre Dame was it. It was it. And what differentiated that was a combination of things: the ethics and the foundation of the coaching, the ethics and the foundation of the institution, the drive for the education. That was so important to me. There was only one choice, and could have gone anywhere else, but there's only one choice. And I think that's a really big issue right now in today's sporting world. It's a huge issue. How these kids are choosing the schools. And there's just too many occasions where the kids are leaving school early, and even times when they're graduating and they don't have the requisite skills necessary to be successful in the future. I think what we have to understand is a simple fact. When you play in big-time sports, especially football, for instance, only 3% go on to play in a professional career. And of that 3%, the average tenure is only 3 years. You need an education. And I think that's what I was successful at with parents who were very driven by that, who weren't really well-educated themselves, who were laborers, is that you're going to get the education, and you're going to go to a place where you're going to get that education and where they're going to instill a discipline in you. And I think that's what I adore, what I just adore about the University of Notre Dame.
Well, and this is Brian, definitely amazing school. So As you look at today and you think about kind of the HR practice and function, where's been some things in your career, like defining moments that you've made a decision, you've looked back on and said, thank goodness I made that decision?
Yeah, you know, there's so many of those in life. You know, I think when I first started out, I started off in social service delivery. I was a theology major studying theology as a Methodist at a Catholic university, and I was studying to be a minister, and I ended up being an ordained minister. And my whole focus was on social service delivery. And I pastored two churches when I first came out of college. So my tenure was really headed down towards the social service delivery side. I was working as the head of civil rights for the state of Indiana. And the governor got moved out of office, and I had to go find another job. And I stumbled on a newspaper article looking for a factory supervisor on the shop floor. I never thought about HR, and I went to work there, and I was very successful with United Technologies Corporation, and I skyrocketed. My career all of a sudden changed. That was a pivotal moment that I think transcended where I was headed towards where I am today. That is not to say that I have not given up that foundation I have, a service, because I think that's what HR is, a service to people and the development of people. And while the other things I do in my life always pull me back to my religious roots, the human resources element of my life gave me a new direction. So I think that was a key issue. And I think the second key issue was the first time I got laid off from a job. I thought I was really good, and I got laid off, and I was shocked. The ability to redirect my career right then was important. You know, how do you regather yourself, and how do you look at that event as an opportunity rather than something devastating? Now, so many people are facing that today. It's the reason why I do a lot of work in working and coaching people around transitioning from one career to another, because it's a great challenge today, as we know, in the marketplace.
The great answer, by the way. And mentoring programs, where do you see that, like, jumping into or wrapping around, like, a talent function with companies, the value?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Important question. I'm in the process right now of developing a new executive orientation program for a corporation, and what's important about that is that too often as you get hired in a new organization, for instance, the person comes in and we just throw them the work. My philosophy has been you cannot do that. You have to lay out a very full integration program, and I call it it's orientation, assimilation, and integration. And what is the culture of the organization? What is the culture that you bring or your values you bring, and how do you mesh those two things together? And I think there's a framework that you have to use to make sure that the organizations are successful in that. And I think there's a mentoring process. So I always like to assign a senior person to a new person coming into the organization, no matter what level they're at, that gives them guidance and direction. And I don't think that mentor should be within their hierarchical line. It should be somebody who's removed from the direct dealing with them, but a person who has the ability and the tenure with the organization to understand its political dynamics, its external and internal political dynamics, and how it operates culturally, and to give assistance and guidance into how you can bring your values into an organization. It is not to say that you're supposed to adapt 100%. The whole idea of hiring diverse and inclusive thought processes is to bring newness in, but you can't just throw it in. You have to integrate it in a particular way. So even in my internship programs, we hired a company. I helped them hire 35 interns last summer. Every one of those interns had a mentor outside of their direct line, and that mentor's job was to meet with them on a weekly basis to discuss successes and failures, to give them the roadmap to success, to help guide them through goals. You know, we give them all specific goals to achieve, to teach them proper presentation characteristics of the organization. When I'm going to stand up in front of the group, how do I present? What are the right things to say? You know, give them guidance and direction. So mentoring is absolutely vital today, I believe. And it's not just at the bottom of the organization. It's throughout the organization. And I highly covet that as a tool that the best organizations use as a best practice.
What about the reverse mentoring? Do you see value in that at all, or is that just a fad? Do you really think that's got legs?
I'm not sure what you mean. Reverse meaning from senior people down. From lower levels up the organization.
Yeah, taking literally the Gen Y-er 25-year-old and putting him with, you know, the female CEO who is 59 years old.
Well, I got an attitude adjustment about 6 months ago from a group of young folks that I was working with at the company, and I was giving them advice and consultation. They were giving me, it was a training program, and I got feedback from them, and they told me that I was out of touch. And I kind of shook my head and go, well, out of touch? I'm not out of touch. And so that was a little reverse mentoring going on. And when I really peeled back the onion on what they were saying, they're probably true. It was probably true, but the important point of it was that I had to be open to that feedback, because while what I was saying was not wrong, what I was saying was not taking enough into account of where they are mentally and where they're mentally prepared to go. And so one of the pieces of feedback is stop talking about young people and start talking about people with less experience growing into more experience. And don't make it a chronological issue, but make it, similar to what you said, it's more of a cultural change issue. And I think that was good feedback. And I call that reverse mentoring, okay? So I think there's some value to it. We have a lot to learn as baby boomers from the new generation. Social media demands have changed. Now, there's good change and there's bad change to that. You know, one of my concerns is that the newer generation, they expect to communicate in a far different way. But yet, what I think the liability to that is, they don't tend to be as formal and as politically astute in the social media exchange as what they should be and what you actually need to be successful in your organization. So I think there's balance there, but there is learning that's got to go on both ways. There's no question about that, and I accept that as somebody that I got to constantly learn from those young folks that are underneath me.
All right, Marv, with 3 minutes left, I got to ask you. If you could wave a magic wand, would you pay college athletes in today's market? This is a compensation question, ironically. Would you pay college athletes today? If so, why? If not, why?
The answer is no. And the operative word is pay. No, I would not. However, even when in my day in the 70s playing, I needed money. My parents were able to give me $10 a month spending money. Fortunately, I had a girlfriend who had a little bit of money, so I couldn't buy a pizza and take her on a date. But athletes need to have a stipend that is sufficient to allow them to perform and to interact socially in the same way as others might similarly situated do. Now, the reason why that is so important is multiple points. One of the key points is that it has become a 12-month of the year commitment. Those kids cannot go out and get summer jobs like we used to be able to. I used to get construction jobs in the summer. Now they're there 12 months of the year. Where are they going to get money to spend? There has to be a system that allows a fair and equitable way to give kids the amount of money and to teach them to use that money properly so that they can have a normal social life. If you don't do that, you're going to continue to have this under-the-table stuff and problems that go on because it's all their young kids and they want money, they need money, they want to be able to buy the things they need to buy, they want to be able to go out on dates, et cetera. I do not believe as much money as the collegiate environment makes, I don't think this is about pay. You know, so I have a different philosophy about it than a lot of people. I don't see that being an appropriate marketplace, not in American football and American basketball and our traditional sports. I just don't think it works. It'll get out of control too quick. I think the issue has to be is being able to equitably give people the amount of money they need to learn how to manage money, manage accountability, manage responsibility, and to have a normal life. It's a tough question, though. It is a real tough question.
Well, that was a great answer. Thank you for kind of sharing your perspective on that. We got about 60 seconds left, so definitely, where can folks connect up with you if they have additional questions or just want to just socialize with you?
Sure. Well, marvrussell.com, that's where I'm at. That's where I hang out at. You can find my Twitter feeds from there. And you can join me. I do a lot of communication via social media. But if you go to marvrussell.com, you'll be able to engage with me on Facebook, on Twitter, Instagram, anyway, Google Chat, any way you want to. So just go there, and you'll see my books there, and you'll see the work that I do, and you'll see how to communicate with me on a regular, everyday basis. And I hope people read my books because I think I've given them some great insights into how to be successful in their careers and in their life in general. And I especially just leave that message, we got to continue to work with our young folks and develop their capabilities, and they're going to be great.
Well, fantastic. Marv, thanks for coming on with lunch with us, folks. We're out of here. Have a great Monday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
A German beer with a Cuban cigar in the middle of Paris with a Dominican bar. Great head on her shoulders. She probably studied abroad. She transferred to Harvard from King's College in March.